Mr. Schlafinger.
May it please the court. Ms. Hennage. Jeffrey Schlesinger on behalf of appellants Herman Hicks, Radar Tyler, and Dreyfus Harbin, Your Honor. This case involved an alleged conspiracy to distribute crack cocaine in Gary, Indiana, which lasted over approximately 4 years. It ended with the arrests of several people in May of 1998. Any case that alleges a conspiracy to distribute, an underlying agreement is always inferred from the activities of the parties. Especially as the government cited from Sanchez in their brief, in the murky world of illicit drugs, conspiracies are by necessity loose-knit organizations. I'm unaware of any drug conspiracy in which there's ever been a written agreement, and there's rarely an explicit verbal agreement. This court has dealt with the problem posed by identification of conspiracies on numerous occasions, particularly in the case of United States versus Lechuga, which was an en banc hearing and which resulted in 6 separate opinions being written. We have challenged sufficiency of the evidence to establish the conspiracy in this case. Lechuga led to the decisions in United States versus Rivera and United States versus Contreras, in which the Seventh Circuit held that there was not sufficient evidence to establish the conspiracy, and also identified 4 plus factors which will assist the court. They're not elements of the crime, but they were designed to assist the court in determining whether, in fact, the conspiracy existed. The first of those factors is length of the relationship. In the alleged 4 years that this drug conspiracy existed, the leader of the conspiracy was undisputedly Tawan Allen. Now, Mr. Allen did have a long relationship with Mr. Hicks and Mr. Tyler. They were mentioned in the course of evidence at numerous crack houses that Mr. Allen operated. He did not, however, have a long relationship with Mr. Harbin. Mr. Harbin was 18 years old at the time he was arrested, and he was involved in the conspiracy a shorter period of time. We would contend approximately 3 months. I believe the government alleges 6 months in their brief. That one plus factor we would concede that was probably met by the evidence in the case. However, the other factors, the second is an established method of payment. And one factor that the courts have consistently looked at in discussing established method of payment is whether the seller or the leader of the conspiracy fronted any drugs to the individual members. This fronting is a method of sale in which the drugs are given without payment to the seller down the line. The seller then pays and splits the profit. There was one allegation of fronting regarding the defendants Hicks and Tyler. There was no allegation regarding fronting concerning Harbin.
Are you saying there was a conspiracy, but Harbin didn't join it? Is that your?
No, I represent Mr. Harbin at trial. I'm somewhat more familiar with his evidence. I'm saying, looking at all of the plus factors, that even Hicks and Tyler will not fall in. But I'm conceding that their involvement was longer and, frankly, they were fronted on at least one occasion, according to the evidence.
You're saying there wasn't any conspiracy at all, is it?
Not
basic position.
Not involving Allen with either Hicks, Tyler, or Harbin. There was no regular method of payment. In fact, there was no testimony from Allen regarding selling drugs to any of those 3 individuals. It was clear, and there's a clear inference from the evidence, that they did receive drugs from Allen on some occasions, but there's, other than the one testimony about fronting over a 4-year period, there's no indication of the method in which they would pay for drugs on other occasions. The third plus factor identified was whether the transactions were standardized. In this case, they were not. They had, again, a length of time. Although Mr. Allen ran a series of crack houses and there was testimony regarding each of the houses, there were different individuals in each of the houses at different times. Some of the individuals purchased drugs from someone other than Mr. Allen and were permitted to sell in the houses. Some of the individuals were from the 22nd Avenue area, which was the government's term for the conspiracy, but some of them were from outside the area. Customers would come to the house and purchase drugs from individuals, but beyond that, there was not testimony about the weight of the drugs sold, the method in which they were sold. Sometimes there was street rolling going on outside the houses, and other times there was not. The final plus factor that the court has pointed out is the level of trust involved between the co-conspirators. Again, we believe that there is not evidence sufficient to show a conspiracy regarding these individuals based on a level of trust. At one time, defendant Tyler actually got into a conflict with Mr. Allen, and it resulted in his being pistol whipped by Allen. It was over competing sales. We're not claiming that Tyler withdrew from the conspiracy because the case law is clear that that requires a formal withdrawal. However, it does bear upon the level of trust between the individuals. What we have in this case is a number of people selling from the same geographic location. We do not believe that it's significantly different than individuals selling on street corners. Perhaps buying from the same supplier, perhaps taking turns, but that in itself does not constitute a conspiracy without some evidence on the plus factors. And the reason that we believe that the plus factors are so important, although they are not elements of the crime, is the disparate punishment that these individuals face. My client, Mr. Harbin, was 18 years old at the time of his arrest. He was found guilty of involvement in the conspiracy, he was charged with the weight of all the drugs sold by the conspiracy over the time that he was involved, and he received a sentence of 32 years. Because of the draconian nature of the drug sentences, particularly involving crack cocaine, we ask that the court hold that these plus factors are important and need some addressing by the government when they're proving their case. The second issue that we raised was the introduction of the murder of Dontrell Hamilton, which was alleged in the course of the conspiracy, and also other violent acts. We believe that the trial judge should have done a balancing, but he did do the balancing on the murder of Hamilton and felt that its probative value outweighed its prejudicial effect. We concede that it's prejudicial, but in a case like this, again, although the murder occurred in one of the crack houses, there was no testimony that it was in furtherance of the conspiracy at all. There was a dispute between the members, the people selling there that evening, none of whom were a defendant in this case, and the dispute was resolved by shooting to death one of the people in the house. Unless that's in furtherance of the conspiracy and somehow shows that it's advancing their joint purpose, we do not believe that that should have been admitted. The final point I wish to address was only concerns defendant Harbin, and that is that he did attempt to plead guilty to this case. In this case was remanded for retrial after reversal in the initial trial, and Mr. Harbin entered into a plea agreement with the government. The government did require that both co-defendants also plead guilty for Harbin to receive the benefit. And we're not saying that Harbin should have, the trial judge correctly considered the plea agreement a contract and did not enforce its terms. However, in the sentencing, we believe that Harbin accepted responsibility by attempting to enter his plea agreement. And what concerns me the most about Harbin's denial of acceptance responsibility is both the trial court's and the government's assertion that he put the government to its burden of proof at trial. This is a case where we objected to withdrawing the plea agreement and asked the court to enforce its terms in any event. The court refused to do that, and we could have pled in the blind, but again, in light of the sentence that I've already indicated to the court, and in light of the fact that we contested the weight of the drugs attributable to Harbin, which we were subsequently found correct on, and he did receive a lesser sentence, we believe that he should have received acceptance of responsibility for attempting to file the plea and attempting to enforce that before the trial. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Schlesinger. Ms. Hennage?
May I please the court? We've argued in our brief that the evidence was more than ample to first of all show the conspiracy. I'm not sure if there was a concession that the conspiracy itself was proven at trial, but we think clearly it was. Then the issue for the court would be whether or not these three defendants on appeal knew about the conspiracy, and then second, whether they joined that conspiracy. And again, we've argued that there's ample evidence to show both of those elements. In terms of the knowledge of the three defendants, we would admit that the involvement of Mr. Hicks and Tyler went on much longer than for Mr. Harbin. Also, their roles were slightly different. When you look at the evidence, which was outlined in both briefs, Mr. Hicks and Tyler operated at, I think, 11 of the 13 crack houses operated by Mr. Allen, and Mr. Harbin came in late and operated at about 3 of those. More of the evidence pointed to Hicks and Tyler being involved with the acts of violence. The reason for that, in part, is that many of those acts occurred prior to Mr. Harbin joining into the agreement. But the evidence shows that Hicks and Tyler clearly knew that Allen was operating a crack houses, actually for the 22nd Avenue Boys. And those two individuals went from house to house. Sometimes they were fronted drugs by Allen, fronted on credit. Sometimes they bought their own drugs but sold them out of his houses. Sometimes that would be Hicks and Tyler, they would actually buy the drugs and sell them to Allen. But the drugs were distributed out of the crack house, and that was the essence of the conspiracy. It was a two-pronged conspiracy, an agreement to possess with the intent to distribute crack cocaine, but also to distribute the crack cocaine. With respect to Mr. Harbin, who came in late, his role seemed to be taking a little different tack in terms of maybe being a right-hand person to Allen. The evidence showed clearly that when Mr. Allen opened his last crack house in the spring of 1998, that Harbin, who was relatively new to the group, but that he was there organizing that house from the beginning, and he was there apparently dispensing drugs to at least Irving, who owned the front apartment. So his involvement is a little different, but it's the same. The evidence clearly showed that he also was selling crack out of Allen's crack houses. I think the evidence with respect to him was that he was buying crack from Allen. In other words, Allen was selling it to him. Whether that was on a frontal basis or not, I'm not sure the record was clear. In terms of the acts of violence and the murder, we've maintained that those acts were all integral to the conspiracy, which was crack distribution in the Midtown area of Gary. There were a lot of turf battles between the 22nd Avenue Boys, who operated in Midtown, and two or three other gang areas, Aetna, Delaney, Marshalltown. And when you look at the chronology of the evidence, it's clear the conspiracy included the violence in order to keep the group together and to keep their turf in Midtown to make it more lucrative for everybody. There were battles that went on back and forth with the other gangs as well as with sellers. With Mr. Harbin, again, his involvement, he was not involved until later, but shortly before he joined, there was the murder of another gang member, and the Hamilton murder occurred at the house that he organized. He was present earlier in the morning. We've argued in the brief that the murder of Hamilton was an attempt by Mr. Allen to show everyone that he controlled the group, and that if somebody was out of step, in this case Hamilton was accused of stealing somebody else's crack, that Mr. Allen would show all of the other people in his group that they better not do that. So we've argued that not only was the evidence sufficient for the conspiracy, but that the court did not abuse its discretion in admitting the acts of violence. With respect to the third issue, the issue raised by Mr. Harbin, unless there are any questions from the bench, we would rest on a brief.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Hennish. Mr. Schlesinger, how much time do we have? 1 minute?
Your Honor, I apologize for not recalling who wrote the opinion, but in United States versus Thornton, one of the judges of this court likened our burden challenging sufficiency to hearing a warbler in inner city Chicago in February with perhaps a bionic ear. I understand the weight of our burden, and certainly today you might not hear that warbler, but last week, to most people's surprise, it would have been possible. The point I'm trying to stress is that there is evidence of drug distribution in this case, and there's a lot of evidence of drug distribution. That by itself does not make a conspiracy. The acts of violence that the government points to, none of those were necessarily related to drug trafficking. The fact that there are street gangs in Gary, Indiana, or any other locale is a cause for concern and may result in these turf battles. There were shootings at a nightclub and at the Genesis Center in Gary, but there was no evidence regarding why those shootings occurred other than they were shootings between rival gangs. I think the government's making an assumption that that was related to the drug trafficking.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schlesinger. And you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, I was.
So, well, the court thanks you for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you.